Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I'm your host, and I really hope you're bundled up for this one today.
Oh, definitely. You're going to need a sweater for this topic. I'm your resident expert, and I'm excited to get into this.
Yeah, because we are setting the coordinates for a specific place and time that on the surface might seem a little quiet, maybe even a little frozen.
Very frozen.
Right. We're heading back to the early 1970s.
It's such a fascinating, complex era. I mean, the world was just changing so rapidly.
It really was.
Yeah.
But we aren't going to the disco floors of New York or the political corridors of D.C.
Yeah.
We aren't looking at Vietnam. We're heading north.
Far north.
Exactly. We are going to Finland.
The land of the north, as they called it.
Right. Now, to really get into this, we have to set the stage for you because context is just everything here. It's the height of the Cold War, and Finland is this neutral buffer zone. It shares this massive, heavily guarded border with the Soviet Union. So it's a place of political tension, sure. But our focus today isn't on geopolitics or, you know, international espionage.
No, it's on a completely different kind of front line.
Exactly.
We're looking at a cultural and spiritual front line. We're looking at the collision of two very, very different worlds.
We have this stack of memoirs, journals, and personal accounts, what we are calling the Finland Diaries.
Right.
And these come from young American and Finnish missionaries serving in the Finland mission.
Right.
We're specifically focusing on the era under the leadership of Mission President Robert G. Wade between 1972 and 1975.
And what stands out immediately when you read these documents is just the sheer texture of the experience. I mean, you have to picture this.
Yeah, set the scene for us.
You have these young Americans, kids really, 19 or 20 years old. Many of them had literally never left their home states of Utah, Idaho, or Arizona.
Right, they grew up in the high desert.
Exactly, or the mountains. And suddenly, they are dropped into a world of endless winter nights.
Yeah.
A language that is notoriously one of the most difficult to master on the entire planet. And a culture that is deeply reserved.
It is the ultimate fish out of water scenario.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about survival here.
Absolutely.
Not just spiritual survival, trying to keep their faith intact, but literal physical adaptation to extreme changes in light, heat, ice, and silence.
And that's the key. The mission of this deep dive isn't just about theology or conversion statistics.
Right. If it were just numbers, we'd just be reading a spreadsheet.
Exactly. This is about cultural collision. It's about the psychology of belief. We're looking at how these young people navigated these really deep questions of existence while simultaneously trying to figure out how to work a sauna without burning their own ears off.
Oh, we are definitely getting to the saunas.
You have to.
You cannot do Finland without the sauna. But essentially, we want to explore the human side of this work. We want to look past the official reports and see the specific, gritty details of life in 1970s Finland.
And to understand the ripple effects, too, because as we'll see, a conversation in a frozen park or a knock on a door in 1974 is still creating waves decades later. It's like the chaos theory of human interaction.
I love that. So let's jump right into the deep end, or I guess in this case, the hot end. We have to talk about the cultural plunge.
The sauna.
The sauna. You cannot talk about Finland without talking about it. It is central to their identity. In the U.S., a sauna is maybe something you see at a fancy gym.
Right. Go. And it's usually lukewarm and smells like old towels.
Exactly. But in Finland, it's a national institution. There are literally more saunas than cars in Finland.
It's where business gets done. It's where families bond. Traditionally, it's even where women gave birth because it was the cleanest room in the house.
Wow. I didn't know that. So we have this hilarious account from a missionary named Scott Anderson that really illustrates the power dynamics involved here.
Oh, this is a classic story. So Anderson is living in Helsinki with his companion, Elder Brunson. Now, usually missionary apartments are pretty Spartan, you know, hand-me-down furniture, drafty windows.
Very basic living.
Right. But they managed to score an apartment that actually has access to a really high-quality sauna.
Which, let's be honest, in a Finnish winter where the sun sets at 3 in the afternoon and it's 20 below zero, is a massive luxury.
Absolute luxury. It's a sanctuary for them. But here's where the hierarchy of mission life comes into play. You have to understand the structure to get the joke here.
Okay, lay it out for us.
You have the mission president at the top, but then underneath him, you have the APs, the assistants to the president.
The dreaded APs.
Right. These are other young missionaries, usually a bit older or more experienced, who have been selected as leaders. They travel around the country checking on the other missionaries.
Making sure they're hitting their goals.
Working hard, following the strict rules. Exactly.
Essentially, they are the middle management of the mission.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys with the clipboards.
That is the perfect way to describe them. And these APs figure out that Anderson and Brunson have this top-tier sauna. So naturally, they start dropping by to join them.
A little perk of leadership. Let's go inspect Elder Anderson's apartment and bring a towel.
But it comes with strings attached. This wasn't just a friendly hangout. The APs would sit in the sauna and start grilling Anderson and Brunson about their statistics.
Oh, no.
Yeah. How many discussions did you teach? How are your numbers? Why aren't you working harder?
Talk about a buzzkill. You're trying to relax in the steam. You're entirely vulnerable. And suddenly, it's a corporate performance review.
It's a high-stress environment in a very small hot room. So Elder Brunson develops a defensive tactic. He calls it the sauna battle.
This is my favorite part of the logs. It's literal psychological warfare using thermodynamics.
It's brilliant. Brunson knew something the APs didn't, or at least he had a much higher tolerance for it. He liked his sauna extremely hot. So the moment the APs would start talking about goals or numbers or schedules, Brunson wouldn't argue.
He wouldn't get defensive.
No, he would just grab the ladle.
The nuclear option.
He would dump two or three massive scoops of water onto the rocks.
Now, for the listener who hasn't been in a real Finnish sauna, you have to explain the physics of what happens there. Because it's not just that the room gets hotter.
No, not at all. It creates loyalili. That's the Finnish word for the steam that rises from the rocks. It's this sudden blast of steam that instantly spikes the humidity in the room.
Right.
The actual temperature on the thermometer on the wall doesn't necessarily jump up immediately, but the heat transfer to your skin becomes immediate and intense.
It's the difference between sticking your hand in a dry oven and sticking it over boiling water.
Exactly. It feels like your skin is melting. It stings the nostrils. It burns the tips of your ears.
So he is weaponizing the steam to shut down the meeting.
Precisely. Anderson describes the visitors literally rubbing their ears in pain and fleeing the room. They couldn't take the heat. They'd scramble out to the dressing room, gasping for air.
That is amazing. You want to talk about key performance indicators? Here, have some third-degree steam.
Huh, exactly. And the takeaway from Anderson is really funny. He says, "We never did make any goals while taking our sauna."
I bet.
But beyond the humor of it, it shows this real resilience. They bonded over it. Anderson admits that eventually he built up a tolerance. He could take the heat. It became a rite of passage for them.
It's about adapting to the environment to survive the pressure, literally and metaphorically.
Mm-hmm.
If you can handle the loyalty, you can handle the rejection on the street.
That's spot on. It toughens you up.
But the cultural challenges weren't just about heat. They were also about navigating traditions that seem familiar on the surface to an American, but are actually quite different. We have a great story from Richard Rose about Christmas.
Ah, yes, the Jalupuki.
The Finnish Santa. Now, most Americans think Santa is a universal concept. Red suit, big beard, ho, ho, ho. But the Finnish version is, well, it's different.
Very different. And this is a really great example of cultural nuance. In the U.S., Santa Claus is this magical, elusive figure. He comes down the chimney while you're asleep. You never actually see him.
Right. It's a passive experience for the kids. They wake up and the presents are just there.
But in Finland.
In Finland, the Jalupuki comes to the door on Christmas Eve. He knocks. He comes inside. He sits down.
He's a guest.
He's an interactive guest who interrogates the children.
Right. So set the scene for us. It's the winter of 1974. Sister Wade, the mission president's wife, asks Richard Rose to dress up as the Jalupuki for the Wade family's Christmas Eve celebration.
And remember, the Wades have five children. And at this point, those children have been living in Finland for a while. They are immersed in local schools. They have Finnish friends. They know exactly how this is supposed to go.
So Rose puts on the costume, he knocks on the door, and he initiates the traditional song.
Yeah.
It's a call and response song. The Jalupuki asks if his sack is heavy, if the journey from Korvatunturi, that's the mountain where he supposedly lives, was long. And crucially, he asks if the children have been kilty.
Kilty.
It means good or well-behaved. It's the moment of judgment.
But there's a huge snag in the plan.
The language. Rose admits in his journal that the Wade children probably spoke far better Finnish than he did.
Oh, boy.
So you have this young American missionary sweating in this suit, struggling through the Finnish verses, mispronouncing words, and trying to convince these very sharp American kids that he's the authentic Finnish Santa.
It sounds agonizingly awkward. It's a really humble moment.
It is. But Rose reflects on it with a lot of warmth, actually. He notes that despite the awkwardness, the Finnish way interacting with the children rather than sneaking around in the dark actually felt right. It was better. It was about presence, not just presence.
It forces a connection. And that seems to be a major theme here. You can't just observe the culture from a distance. You have to participate, even if you look a little foolish doing it. You have to put on the suit and sing the song.
Even if you sing it completely off-key.
Right. And speaking of singing off-key and looking foolish, let's talk about the biggest hurdle of all. The Great Wall of Finland. The language itself.
Finnish. It is a distinct beast.
I've always heard it's one of the hardest languages for English speakers to learn.
It is. It's not Indo-European, it's Uralic. It's related to Estonian and Hungarian, and that's pretty much it. It has 15 noun cases.
15.
15. Think about it. In English, we use prepositions. In the house, on the house, from the house. In Finnish, those are all suffixes attached to the end of the word. And the root word changes based on what you attach to it.
And it sounds impossible.
It's agglutinative. That means they just keep piling suffixes onto words until they are a mile long.
So it's not like picking up a little Spanish or French where you can guess the cognates. You can't just add an O to the end of an English word and hope for the best.
No, absolutely not. If you try to guess, you will be wrong. And we have a really candid admission from Daniel Harding about this. He flat out says he struggled immensely.
Yeah,
he was working hard. He was studying the grammar books. He was memorizing vocabulary lists every day. But it just wasn't clicking for him. He felt totally isolated.
I think anyone who has tried to learn a difficult language as an adult can really relate to that wall. You study, you try, but you just feel like a toddler. You can't express your personality, you can't tell a joke, you can't be you.
You completely lose your identity. And for a missionary whose entire job is to communicate a highly complex message, that silence is devastating.
Right.
And then about 10 months into his mission, everything changes for Harding.
What happened?
It wasn't a new textbook, it wasn't some miracle pill, it was a new companion. He gets assigned to Veli Seppo Puikkonen.
Veli means brother.
Yes. In the church, men are addressed as elder, usually.
Right.
But in Finland, the local men are Veli brother. So Seppo Puikkonen is a native Finn. But here is the kicker. Puikkonen completely refused to speak English.
Oh, the total immersion method.
It was the nuclear option, much like the sauna steam. Harding says this companion would not speak anything but Finnish with him. If Harding asked a question in English, Puikkonen would answer in Finnish, or he would just stare at him in silence until he tried in Finnish.
That would be incredibly frustrating in the moment. I would be so annoyed.
Oh, I'm sure there were moments of deep tension. But it was effective. It forced his brain to rewire itself. Harding says that was the actual turning point for him.
Wow.
It really highlights that in this environment, comfort was the enemy of progress. If you stayed in your English bubble, which is very easy for Americans to do, just talking to each other, you survived, but you didn't grow. You didn't connect with the people.
And that connection was vital because the people they were trying to talk to weren't simple, uneducated villagers. Finland has an incredibly high literacy rate. These were educated, thoughtful people.
Which brings us to a really important distinction in the Finland mission data. We need to move to the intellectuals and the skeptics.
Right, because the missionaries weren't usually teaching new information in the sense of introducing the Bible or basic Christian concepts. This wasn't like going to a place where people had never heard of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. The Finns knew the Bible. They were Lutherans by long tradition. They went to confirmation school. They were well-read, often skeptical of organized religion, but deeply culturally Christian. The barrier wasn't ignorance. It was intellectualism or deeply ingrained lifestyle habits.
We have a perfect example of this with the story of the widow and the coffee. This comes from Gary Carter.
This story is so atmospheric. I just love the setting. It's Vappu Päivä May Day.
Tell us about Vappu.
This is a massive celebration in Finland. Spring is finally coming. The snow is melting. Students, both current and alumni, wear their white graduation caps. There are balloons, streamers everywhere. People go to the park for picnics, even if it's still freezing outside. Carter describes the scent of sima in the air.
Sima.
It's a traditional fermented lemon drink, kind of a mead specifically made for May Day. It has raisins floating in it.
I can almost smell it. So Carter and his companion are knocking on doors in Hämeenlinna right in the middle of this celebration.
And an older widow opens the door. She's warm, she's inviting. But the moment they introduce themselves as Latter-day Saint missionaries, she cuts right to the chase.
She says, "I know all about your church, but I could never join."
Now, usually when someone says that to a missionary, they mean, "I don't believe your doctrine," or "I have my own church," or "I think you're crazy." But she says, "I can't join because giving up coffee would be impossible."
That is refreshingly honest.
It is deeply honest. And as they talk to her, they realize something fascinating. She actually knows the theology. She tells them that Joseph Smith was a prophet. She tells them the Book of Mormon is true. She knows the church organization is biblical.
She is basically a believer who is stuck on the Starbucks order.
Well, it's the word of wisdom, the church's health code, that forbids coffee, tea, alcohol, and tobacco. Now, for an American, giving up coffee might be a bad headache for a week.
Sure.
For a Finn in the 1970s, coffee isn't just a caffeine delivery system. It is the absolute center of social life.
It's how you welcome guests. It's how you take a break at work. The coffee table is the center of the home.
Exactly. To refuse coffee in Finland is almost an insult. If you go to someone's house and they offer coffee and you say no, it's incredibly awkward. So she calls it a paradox. She says, "I know it's true, and that is why I can't join."
Wow.
She respected the rules enough to know she wasn't ready to live them, so she stayed away.
That is a very high level of integrity, actually. She didn't want to be a hypocrite.
It is. She had been taught years prior, but her husband had forbidden her from joining. Now he had passed away. She was alone. The theology was there, totally dormant in her mind, but the habit was the wall.
So what happened? Did they sit there and argue with her about caffeine?
No, it took gentle reminders. It wasn't about debating scripture. She already knew the scripture perfectly well. It was about encouraging her to make the lifestyle leap. They visited her, they encouraged her, and eventually she did it. She gave up the coffee and was baptized.
It shows that sometimes the barrier isn't asking, "Is this true?" but asking, "Can I actually do this? Can I change my life?"
Precisely. It's the behavioral gap. Now, contrast that with the story of Seppo the Scholar. This comes from Jerry Olson.
Seppo, the golden investigator.
In missionary terms, a golden investigator is the dream scenario. Friendly, interested, stable family. Seppo was all of that. He had a wonderful wife and daughters. He was incredibly welcoming. He let the missionaries in every single time. But he knew too much.
How so?
Olson says that Seppo knew more about the church than the missionaries combined. He had read the standard works, that's the Bible, Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants. He had read James E. Talmage's Jesus the Christ. He had read LeGrand Richards's A Marvelous Work and a Wonder.
He is treating it like a PhD thesis. He's doing the literature review.
Exactly. It was a pure intellectual exercise for him. He enjoyed the debate. He enjoyed the accumulation of knowledge. He liked having the young Americans over to talk high-level philosophy. But for 6 months, absolutely nothing happened. He wouldn't commit to baptism. He was stuck in analysis paralysis.
So how do you break a logjam like that? You can't out-teach him. He's already read the syllabus.
You can't. You cannot win an argument with someone who just wants to argue. And this is where Mission President Wade stepped in. He counseled Olson and his companion to just stop discussing it and issue a direct spiritual challenge. They had to move him from the head to the heart.
So they challenge him to ask God if it's true. Not just read about it, but actually pray about it.
Right. They set a firm appointment for the answer. They said, "We're going to come back next week and we want you to tell us what God said." And the suspense here in the journals is real. Seppo cancels the first appointment.
Oh, no. The missionaries must have been completely crushed.
They were devastated. They thought he was backing out. They thought he was ghosting them. They thought, "We pushed too hard and now we lost him forever." But when they finally meet a week later, the dynamic has flipped completely.
This is the scene with the Book of Memories.
Yes. Back then, missionaries carried these books sort of like yearbooks or scrapbooks where people could write messages or contacts. Olson had left his book with Seppo. When they walk in, Seppo commands him, "Read your book."
And what did he write?
He wrote, "Finally, something beautiful for both of us. I believe that the gospel you preach is the true gospel of Jesus Christ."
I believe. He finally moved from "I know about this" to "I believe this."
It required that shift from data to spiritual confirmation. We see this exact same thing again with the story of the engineer, Brother Michaela.
Right, the guy who called the office himself, which, by the way, never happens.
Rarely happens. David Roberry tells this one. Michaela was an electrical engineer. His questions were deep, highly technical, and completely logical. He wanted to know how the priesthood authority worked almost mechanically. Roberry admits they were intellectually stranded. They couldn't logic their way into his heart.
So they had to fast with him.
They fasted. They stopped arguing and started seeking a spiritual witness, and that is what worked. The pattern here across the mission is clear. In a highly educated society like Finland, facts aren't enough. People needed a transcendent experience to make such a radical change. Logic can get you to the door, but it can't make you walk through it.
And speaking of radical changes, we need to look at the unlikely candidates. Because sometimes the people you think are the least interested turn out to be the most prepared.
This is best illustrated by the story of the bachelor jogger. This comes from William James.
I love the setup here. Missionaries are in a park doing a survey on families. It's a classic low-yield activity. You stand there with a clipboard and annoy people walking by.
And they flag down a guy jogging, Aimo Ohala. And Aimo is the classic uninterested passerby. He tells them, Olen Poikamies, I am a bachelor. I have no family. I have nothing to contribute to your survey on families.
Basically, leave me alone. I'm exercising.
Right. He gives them his address, probably just to get them to go away, and he runs off.
And normally, that contact card would just sit in a desk drawer.
Hmm.
Bachelor, uninterested, runs fast. Done.
It probably would have. But weeks later, on a whim, and motivated by some specific advice from President Wade to focus on prominent names or follow hunches, the missionaries dig his info out of their scripture case. It's late. It's cold. They don't want to go door to door. So they say, let's go see the bachelor.
They go to his apartment. They sell him a Book of Mormon. They leave.
They come back 2 weeks later. Now remember, the previous missionaries had just dropped it off. When William James returns with a new companion, Aimo recognizes him. And he says, Luin Kirajasi.
I read your book.
And the missionaries are skeptical. You read the whole thing in 2 weeks.
I mean, it's a long book. Over 500 pages. It's dense material.
It is. So James decides to test him a little. He asks, what was your favorite part?
The pop quiz. Did you really read it or did you just skim the introduction?
And Aimo doesn't hesitate for a second. He cites the specific story in the Book of Alma, chapter 32, about the seed that is planted and grows a metaphor for faith. And then he cites the Book of Ether,
which is near the very end of the book.
Right. Specifically, the story of the brother of Jared asking the Lord to touch stones to create light for their barges so they wouldn't cross the ocean in darkness.
Wow. That is not something you can just bluff. Those are deep cuts.
And think about the imagery there. Seeds growing, stones glowing in darkness. For a Finn living in a land of agriculture and incredibly long, dark winters, those images resonate profoundly.
That's a great point. The light and the darkness motif must have really hit home for him.
Exactly. He wasn't just reading, he was devouring it. This skeptical bachelor had a spiritual hunger they completely missed in the park.
And the transformation is incredible. This guy, Aimo Ohala, goes on to become a bishop, Piispa Ohala. He marries Ann Torpo. He becomes a pillar of the church in Finland.
From a jogger trying to avoid a survey to a bishop. It's a powerful reminder that you never really know what is going on inside someone's life. You see a poikamies, a bachelor, God sees a future leader.
But sometimes the barrier isn't just disinterest. Sometimes it's a deep feeling of unworthiness. This brings us to Helena Allman.
This is, to me, the most poignant story in the entire collection. It's the one that really gets you in the gut. Helena's cousin introduces her to the church in the early 70s. She goes to the chapel in Haga.
And how does she describe that first visit?
She says she felt dirty.
Dirty. That is a heavy word.
She says, despite the friendliness of the people, she wished she could roll along the walls to hide. She felt so out of place, so unworthy of the cleanliness she perceived there. She was a smoker. She felt like her life was messy compared to these polished Americans and Finns.
That is heartbreaking, that feeling of, I don't belong here. But she didn't run away.
No, she didn't. She walked out and immediately threw her cigarettes in the trash. It was an instinctive reaction. She bought a Book of Mormon because it was, as she said, beautiful and cheap, three finish marks.
But there was a major theological block for her, and it wasn't coffee. It wasn't the cigarettes.
It was her mother. Helena's mother had died when Helena was only 5 years old. Her mother was a pious, deeply religious woman, but she had never heard of this Mormon church.
So Helena's thinking, if this is the only true church and my saintly mother didn't know about it, does that mean she's damned? Does that mean I'll never see her again?
Yeah, exactly. She couldn't accept a theology that left her mother behind. She couldn't accept a heaven that didn't include her mother. And this is a very common concern in missionary work, especially in countries with strong family bonds. What about my ancestors?
And this is where the specific doctrine of the spirit world changed everything for her.
Right.
Explain that for our listeners who might not be familiar with the theology.
In Latter-day Saint theology, there is a belief that after death, missionary work continues in the spirit world. People who didn't have a chance to hear the gospel in life, like Helena's mother, are taught it there, and they can accept it or reject it. And then the living perform baptisms on their behalf in temples.
So it's retroactive. Everyone gets a fair shot.
Exactly. When the sister missionaries explained this to her,
she says it blew her mind.
It cleared the path entirely. It meant her mother wasn't lost. She was just waiting. That relief allowed her to be baptized. It solved the logic puzzle of her heart.
But the cost was high for her. We have to talk about her father.
Yes. Her father was furious. He was very traditional. He told her, "My best daughter has joined Satan's church."
Ouch. That stings.
When she decided to serve a mission herself later, he refused to give her any money. He refused to help her with her bags.
She describes carrying her own heavy suitcases to the train station, hiding her tears.
It's a stark reminder of the social cost of conversion in a place where the church was viewed with deep suspicion. It wasn't just joining a club. It was seen as a betrayal of heritage. But Helena's resilience is amazing. She served that mission. She served senior missions later in Trinidad and Guyana. She built a massive legacy of faith from that one moment of feeling dirty in the chapel.
It's incredible. Now, we've talked about the successes, the Amos, the Helenas, but life in the field wasn't always a highlight reel. We need to talk about the reality of the grind.
The reality of the rusty water.
This story comes from Scott Lundberg. And just a quick note for the fact checkers listening out there. This story happens under Mission President Orville Nelson around 1972, just before the Wade era really kicks off.
Right. So Lundberg is sent to Hämeenlinna. It's a really tough town. There had been a chapel there, but the area had been closed for a while because of a total lack of success. No baptisms. It was a severe dry spell.
Literally and figuratively.
But then a man comes off the street. He wants to be baptized. It's a miracle. They rush to prepare the font.
Now, usually the font is filled with nice, clean, warm water.
They turn on the tap.
And the water comes out orange. Brown.
Rust. Pure rust. The pipes hadn't been used in so long that the iron had completely oxidized. They try to dilute it by hauling hot water from the kitchen, running back and forth with pots and pans, but it's hopeless. The water is murky and gross.
Imagine the scene. You have this sacred, holy ordinance, white clothing. You want it to be perfect. You want it to look like a painting. And you're stepping into a tub of orange sludge.
But they proceeded. They baptized him in the rust. And I think that's the profound point Lundberg is making here. The water wasn't perfect. The conditions weren't perfect. But the ordinance was valid. It's a metaphor for the whole mission experience. You work with what you have. You don't wait for things to be perfect to do good.
And the aftermath is funny. He sends a telegram to the president reporting a baptism. And the president replies, telling him to quit joking.
He literally didn't believe it was possible in that city until he saw the paperwork.
It speaks to how difficult the work truly was, which leads into Gary Carter's harvest metaphor. He reflects on the fact that he baptized the widow who had been taught years earlier.
He reaped what others had planted.
Exactly. He calls it a river of work. The missionaries who originally taught her never saw the success. They probably went home thinking they completely failed. They probably thought, we wasted our time.
But Carter says, often in the land of the North, it was painfully slow. You had to trust that the seeds you were planting would grow long after you were gone.
It's a massive lesson in patience. You are part of a continuum. You might not be the harvester. You might just be the one tilling the frozen soil.
And that takes a very different kind of faith.
Now, we can't do a deep dive on this era without talking about the leadership. The Wades.
Robert and Faye Wades, they were the center of gravity for this whole mission. They brought their five children to Finland, which really softened the image of the church. They were a family, not just corporate administrators.
And we have Scott Anderson mentioning that the mission environment, the culture the Wades built, drove him to read the Book of Mormon cover to cover for the first time. He needed his own testimony to survive there.
But the absolute pinnacle of that era, spiritually speaking, was the visit of Spencer W. Kimball in August 1974.
At this time, he is the president of the church, the prophet.
This was a massive deal. The missionaries gathered in Helsinki. Mike Bosley describes the feeling in the room as if the building itself was lifting off the ground. The energy was just electric.
But there is a very specific, very personal story from Daniel Harding, remember him, the guy who struggled with the language about this visit. And it involves that gift of tongues we hinted at earlier.
This is a remarkable account. So Harding, the guy who had to go through the silent treatment to learn Finnish, is asked to translate the meeting for the Finnish sisters sitting in the back.
Why did they need translation?
The meeting was in English because President Kimball was speaking English, but there were local Finnish sisters there who didn't speak English at all. So Harding is in the back row, whispering the translation to them while the prophet speaks.
That is a high-pressure gig. Simultaneous translation is hard enough, but translating the prophet.
Exactly. President Kimball is speaking. Suddenly, he pauses. He stops mid-sentence. He whispers something to President Wade, who is sitting on the stand. Wade whispers to an assistant. The assistant walks down the aisle, all the way to the back where Harding is sitting.
Now, imagine being Harding. You're young, you're nervous. The prophet has stopped speaking and sent a messenger directly to you. He's thinking, what did I do wrong? Am I too loud? Am I distracting him? Am I fired?
His heart must have been pounding out of his chest. The assistant leans in and says, President Kimball would like to know if you need a drink of water.
Wow. Just wow.
In the middle of addressing the entire mission, the leader of the church noticed one young man whispering in the back, realized he was translating, and was concerned for his throat.
That is a level of empathy and awareness that is honestly startling. He wasn't entirely focused on his speech. He was focused on the people.
It is, but it gets even more intense. After the meeting, as President Kimball is walking out, he stops directly in front of Harding. He looks him right in the eyes. He puts both hands on Harding's shoulders.
And what does he say?
He says, Elder, you have been given the gift of tongues.
The ultimate validation. After all the struggle, the hard work, the immersion, the feeling of stupidity, the prophet confirms it.
It's a hugely powerful moment. It transforms his struggle into a spiritual gift. And there is a beautiful coda to this story. Years later, back in Utah, Harding is at a homecoming for a relative. President Kimball is there. Harding goes up to him and says, President, you probably don't remember me.
Which is a very fair assumption. The man meets thousands of people every year.
And Kimball looks him in the eye and says, Helsinki, Finland.
Goosebumps. That is a connection that completely transcends time.
It really encapsulates the intensity of these experiences. These weren't just administrative assignments. They were life-altering events for everyone involved.
So as we pull back and look at this deep dive into the Finland Diaries, what is the grand synthesis here? What does this all mean?
Well, if you look at the source material carefully, the mission wasn't just about converting Finns. It was about the conversion of the missionaries themselves. Look at Anderson in the sauna, learning resilience under literal fire. Look at Harding mastering a near impossible language. Look at James learning to follow a hunch with a jogger in the park.
They went to change Finland, but Finland changed them.
Absolutely. They grew up. They learned that faith isn't just a warm feeling. It's work. It's digging in the snow.
And the ripple effect is undeniable. We talked about Seppo Well, his wife and daughters eventually joined. They went to the temple as a family. We talked about Helena, her son, served a mission in Utah. We talked about Amo. He became a bishop.
And those seeds that Gary Carter talked about, they grew into a multi-generational legacy. The church in Finland today is built on the backs of these freezing, struggling, faithful young people in the 70s.
And on the faith of those first brave Finns who overcame the cultural stigma, the feeling of being dirty, and the intense family pressure to embrace something they believed was true.
It's a profound partnership.
I just keep thinking about the orange water.
It is the perfect image to leave on.
You show up, the water is rusty, the conditions are bad, it's freezing cold, you're exhausted, you'd rather be home. But you do the work anyway. You trust that the rust doesn't invalidate the ordinance. You trust that the effort counts.
That's the real lesson. You don't wait for clear water. You baptize in the rust, you plant seeds in the completely frozen ground, and you trust that the harvest will come, even if you aren't there to see it.
That is a powerful place to end. To you listening right now, here is your final thought for the day. What seeds are you planting right now in your own life where you might not see the sprout for 10, 20, or 50 years? Are you willing to do the work in the orange water?
Something deep to think about.
Thanks for diving in with us. We'll see you next time.